You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
This is going to be a real experience. It's the sort of thing you see on movies about escaping from a country as the borders are coming down. We've got with us Jez Myers, and I can exclusively reveal his fiance. Woo! Anyway, and his fiance, Maria Romanenko, and we are delighted to have them at Greenbelt. I think it's their first time here. So please give them a very warm Greenbelt welcome.
Ой, у лузі червона калина похилилася. Чогось наша славна Україна зажурилася. А ми тую червону калину підіймемо. А ми нашу славну Україну развеселимо.
8 years ago, I first started visiting Ukraine. And I fell in love. No, not with Maria. That actually came several years later. But with Karpaty Lviv. With Karpaty Lviv, the greatest football team in all of Western Ukraine, if you overlook the fact that Shakhtar Donetsk are now based there and they're like loads better. On my first ever visit to Ukraine, I went with my friends Mel and Tony. I'll do it. Mel and Tony to watch the local derby, FK Lviv versus Karpaty Lviv. And I got to watch them play out an absolutely unremarkable 1-1 draw. Now, just so you know, I'm not saying Karpaty Lviv were bad, but that goal was the only goal I saw them score for that visit and the subsequent 5 visits. So, not great. Now, the next day, Steve and I, friends, lads on tour, Brits on tour, Brits on holiday. I'm a clearly very cultured man. So we were looking for somewhere to watch the Premier League. And, well, what came to me down a side street in there, it's like a sign for me that I'd come home. That's right. On the back streets of Lviv is Cantona Bar, an Eric Cantona and Manchester United themed pub. And this for me, it really was coming home. I went inside, I became friends with the owner, Andy, and I started visiting Ukraine several times a year. Started watching United together, watching Karpaty together, became really, really close friends.
And this is me, Maria, standing in Podil in the center of Kyiv. Podil is this lovely, wonderful area of Kyiv. Anybody who's been to Kyiv and knows anything about Kyiv or has lived in Kyiv will have heard about Podil. It's a very historical area, but these days it's full of cafes and bars that are always buzzing with young people. It's also home to this beautiful riverside that is connects. So if you follow it, it goes to a bridge and that connects you to an island, this piece of wilderness in the center of Kyiv. And I would go for runs there. I lived in Podil since 1999. And in 2014, Russia started its illegal annexation of Crimea. That was followed by the war in the Donbas. Again, I live in Podil. That's hundreds of kilometers away. So the war and the invasion and the occupation didn't really impact my life. In 2016, I became a journalist. First, I worked for an English language newspaper, and then I became chief editor of an English language media outlet called Hromadske International. And so, of course, professionally, I reported on what was happening in the south and in the east, but that's professionally. Personally, again, life pretty much continued as normal. In 2021, I worked on a magazine called How We Will Get Crimea Back. And it's essentially an English language magazine that was handed out to 47 UN state leaders who were congregating in Kyiv in August 2021. And it detailed Russia's crimes and human rights violations in occupied Crimea, particularly towards Crimean Tatar journalists and activists. And it's the sort of thing you imagine when there were these reports of Putin having a kill list of Ukrainian journalists and activists in late 2021, early 2022, that I could just tell that I would be on that kill list, having reported on what Russia does to other journalists. And to be honest, I'm proud of her. It's one of my proudest achievements. That, alongside appearing on the Daily Star website with this headline and this caption. In 2020, Jez and I started dating. And to make this work, because I was based in Kyiv and Jez was based in Manchester, is he would come and visit me every month or so and stay for a week or two, and we would use it as an excuse to travel around Ukraine, because there's so much more to see beyond Kyiv. And in this photo, I'm standing in Vinnytsia, which is a city in the center west of Ukraine. Because our relationship started in the middle of the pandemic, and you remember that we all picked up new skills, new interests during the quarantine, Jez was actually teaching himself how to make restaurant-style curries.
Sorry, I just ad-lib here. It was probably eating restaurant-style curries, looking at how I now am. Sorry, carry on.
He passed on that skill to me, and whenever he would visit me in Kyiv, we would make curries together and invite our friends, and really would be a win-win situation, because the friends, they would get to come and eat tasty food, and we'd get to hang out with our friends. But everything changed in February 2022. On February 21st, Jez and I were holidaying in Gdansk in Poland. Putin came out with his video address where he talked about how Ukraine wasn't a real country, Ukrainians weren't a real people, and our language wasn't real, and apparently everything was made up by Lenin about 100 years ago, which for anyone who knows anything about Ukrainian history doesn't make any sense. It's quite ridiculous. But then on the other hand, when it comes from a leader of a country that's in possession of nuclear weapons, it's also quite scary. Nevertheless, we were in Gdansk for a holiday. My intention was always to go back to Kyiv, and so on February 23rd, in the early hours, Jez and I boarded a Ryanair plane to take us from Gdansk to Kyiv.
Landing in Kyiv, we turn our phones on, and we get a message popping up saying Ukraine is about to enter into a state of emergency, the kind of thing that throws you into a panic. I took a bit of time and looked up what a state of emergency meant. And essentially it says, well, there'll be more military on the streets. And also, large-scale public events will now either be cancelled or played behind closed doors. This was a disaster for me. I had tickets to watch Dynamo Kyiv versus Inchilet at the resumption of the Premier League season after 2.5 months. Worse than that, I had tickets to watch Ukraine versus Spain in the basketball. £5 those cost me. Totally, totally gone. But other than that, it was a very ordinary day. People went to work, they went to bars, restaurants, shops. We even went to the local supermarket and stocked up on light bulbs. It was very much an ordinary and typical day.
We went back to my apartment in Podil and I resumed work. I was working for an American media outlet remotely at that point. And again, everything was quite normal, quite boring in a way, probably, until 6 p.m. that evening on February 23rd. My dad gives me a call. He says that he had been told that something unsafe, something bad would happen in the center of Kyiv overnight. And as you remember, we lived in Podil, right in the city center. So my dad suggested that we get a taxi and go about half an hour southwest of Kyiv and stay with my dad for a bit of time and just see what happens. I was not expecting that call. I previously discussed with my dad the chances of this potential invasion that everybody was talking about, and he was always very calm and dismissing that anything would happen, and now he's warning me that I need to get out of my home city. I go to the kitchen and tell Jez what I had been told, and he says, okay, he takes it very seriously, he says, let's go then. But I just completely freeze. See, between fight, flight, and freeze, my brain tends to choose freeze. I know that I need to pack, and to be honest, I hadn't even unpacked from Poland from a couple of hours ago. And I've got this open suitcase in the hallway, and it's already filled with some stuff, and I just decide to add some essentials into there. And so I put in a selection of curry spices so that Jez and I could continue making curries wherever we are. I put in my running stuff so that I could continue running at my dad's. I put in a heated blanket because it's still winter after all. I put in a pack of Lerpak spreadable butter that I had found in Poland just a few hours early, because you can't really find Lerpak in Ukraine. I got really excited. I brought it over, as well as a pack of cheddar cheese and a bottle of red wine and my favorite bottle opener. You know, really all the essentials that you would need whilst fleeing a potential war.
20 minutes later, that's right, that's all Maria had, 20 minutes to pack up her life. And we're in a taxi on the way to her dad's. Maria's on her phone, she's messaging someone. It turns out it's a photographer. She's got a photo shoot at the weekend. I keep trying to explain to her, you're not going to that photo shoot. But like so many Ukrainians, they really couldn't get their head around what was potentially about to happen. I actually had a flight booked 5 days later to go from Kyiv to Manchester. And I figured, if I'm lucky, I can hang out, go around the outskirts of Kyiv, jump on a plane and get home. But I wasn't convinced of that. Now, we arrive at Maria's dad's house, and Maria's downstairs. She's talking to her dad about her life, her friends, her family, the future of her country. I think the enormity sort of feels like it's coming through now, and she looks for flights for me to get me out of the country, but they're all cancelled or full, so I'm there with her. And me, well, I do the only thing a man from Manchester can do at a time like this, on the precipice of a world and life-changing event. I go upstairs and turn on Man United versus Atletico Madrid. Now, United, by the way, were awful that night. Peak Ralph Rangnick era, Joao Felix ran the show in the first half. United should have gone in 3-0 down at half-time, but they only went in 1-0 down. In the second half, Anthony Elanga came on to score his first ever goal for United.
Fred with a nice ball into Bruno Fernandes. Elanga was on the run. Elanga might be in. Chance for Manchester United. Oh, he's scored!
Now, just so you know, that video actually has absolutely nothing to do with the story or anything we're telling you today, but I got to write this, so we all get to watch it and I get to throw in things like that. You can always get up and leave. Just make sure you clap on your way out so I can tell my mum about the standing ovation. Now, I hate it when United lose or when United play badly, which means recently until Carrick was appointed, I've been in a bad mood pretty much after every game. And about midnight we go to bed and I turn to Maria and go, I'm so angry. I'm so furious about this. I don't think I can be any more angry than I am right now. And the next morning we wake up to find out that we've been bombed. And it turns out that, oh, there is a whole new level of anger that you can possibly have. And to make matters worse, well, we are right about there. Wake up.
What's happening?
Russia's invaded.
Invaded? Where?
Everywhere. Pack your bags. We're getting out of here. You see, for me, the decision to leave was really easy and instantaneous. It's not my home, not my country, not my war. More importantly, I'm Jewish. I've been brought up my entire life to know that the first sign of trouble, you get out of there. In fact, the fact I'm standing here in front of all of you guys today is because my ancestors over the years have made that very decision. But first, I had to make some phone calls. Hi, Mum. You know how you thought I was in Poland? Well, I'm not. I'm in Ukraine. But it's okay. I've got a plan. I know how to get us out of here. I didn't have a plan at all, by the way. Oh, and also, Mum, can you send me some money? Now, that'll sound a bit weird to you all, but one of the things that was going on was there was a lot of talk about a cyber attack coming from Russia, and so I didn't want to use my normal bank account in case it got frozen or the card got swallowed. So I had to get my mum to put money on a separate bank account just so I could do that. The second call was to my son's mother. Hi, you know how you thought I was in Poland? She went apoplectic. Not because she actually cared about me, but the concept that I put myself in a position where our child might not have a father anymore if we can't get out. It was not happy times.
Whilst I go back into the freeze mode, I can't believe this is happening to my country.
The first thing we do is have a chat with Maria's dad. And Maria's dad and I agree that we need to get petrol. That's going to be the first resource that goes away. So we take the 10-minute drive to the local petrol station, and this is the sight that greets us as we go. Thousands and thousands of vehicles fleeing the centre of Kyiv. This brought home two truths to us immediately. The first was that this situation was much more serious than we were giving anything any credit for. And secondly, if we were going to be getting out, the longer we left it, the longer we'd be sitting in that traffic. And longer in that traffic, we're sitting ducks. Overall, because of queues to get petrol, it took us just over an hour before we managed to get home.
Whilst Jez and my dad are out getting petrol, I'm facing the hardest decision of my life. See, for Jez, it's easy, not his country. He's got a house waiting for him in Greater Manchester and his family is there. But for me, Ukraine is my home. Ukraine is where my family is. That's where my friends are and my work is, my whole life is. And then if Jez goes and I go with him, then hopefully I'd see my dad when he's back from the petrol station. But what about my mum and my brother? I wouldn't be able to say goodbye to them. And what about my 91-year-old grandmother? Would I ever see her again? No, I've got to stay in Ukraine. But then Jez is leaving. And if Jez goes and I stay, I don't know what's going to happen with the borders over the next few weeks. Will they remain open? Would I be able to pop out and see Jez later? Would he be able to come back and see me? And also, I'm a journalist. You saw the kind of work I was involved in. If Putin is successful with his three-day plan of taking over Ukraine, I'm in real trouble. No, I've got to go with Jez. I can always change my mind later.
Getting back to the house, and I've now got to work on this mysterious plan to get us out. You see, to the northeast, north and east, Russia and Belarus. They're out of the question straight away. To the south, you have Moldova. But that's out too, because it has the Russian enclave of Transnistria. And there was a lot of talk at that time about an attack coming up through Transnistria. This also meant that for me, Slovakia, Hungary and Romania were out. So the only pathway, the only route that we had to get out was to head west through Lviv and into Poland. The only problem that we had with that, everyone else would be doing that journey too. Several months earlier, Maria had a conversation with her dad, and her dad had said, "You're my daughter. In case of an emergency, in case of a real problem, I will do absolutely anything to save you." "Take us to Lviv," we suggested. "Oh, no, 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 not that. Everyone will be going that way." "Like, well, yes, everyone will be going that way. Look at the map. That's why everyone will be going that way. It's the only safe way to go." What he actually meant was he had a summer farm, a dacha, a couple of hours south of Kyiv. And we should go there and hang out for a few days just to see how things played out. Understandably, because of what I said earlier, I was not massively a fan of this plan. In fact, I was dead set against it. Whilst we were having these conversations and working out our plan to the north of the city, other things were happening. Russia had captured Hostomel Airport and were looking to build an air bridge, the air bridge which would allow them to take Kyiv and Ukraine within 3 days. Ultimately, they failed to hold on to that airport, and that's what caused them the situation they now found themselves in. Russia had already captured the AN-225, the world's largest cargo plane, the Dream, Maria, and had set fire to it and destroyed it. 2 days later, to the west of the city, in the village of Maria, Russia had captured that. They were taking pot shots at civilians as they were trying to escape. Had we followed Maria's dad's plan, that's the route we'd have taken out, and they'd have shot at us too. It was only by luck that we made the decision not to follow him.
From the moment I wake up on February 24th and switch on my phone, there's another attack happening in our household, and that's the journalists. See, you give one good interview in English and they all want to talk to you. They find out your social media and they contact you and message you and call you. And when Jez and my dad are outside packing up the car, I'm on the phone to BBC Northern Ireland. And it's that moment when you're listening to the programme live and you're just waiting to be put through to be interviewed live on air. And Jez comes to me and says that we need to go now, we need to get going. And I explain, well, just a few minutes, I've just got to do this interview, okay, and then we'll go. No, we've got to go now. See, I'm a journalist myself. I've secured plenty of interview guests, including for interviews live. And if any of them had cancelled or hung up on me just literally seconds before being interviewed, I wouldn't be happy with that. And I can't do this to other fellow journalists. But then Jez is getting very anxious, very angry. And so I hang up the phone and head to the car.
Maria's dad and I are loading the car. We've finally convinced him to take us to Lviv, but he's really, really unhappy at this. Not only is he unhappy about that, but he's unhappy at our decision. He views this as us turning our back on Ukraine. and that is a decision that he simply cannot countenance. He takes me to one side and he says, "Jez, I just want you to know that you've gone down in my estimation." And I was gutted. And then I realised, wow, this is great. I didn't realise there's a place in your estimation I could go down from. There was an awkward silence, which was punctuated by suddenly the sound of a fighter jet, which meant that we needed to get in the car and set off. And so we did.
The journey from outside of Kyiv to Lviv normally takes 6 hours. That day, it took us 10 hours. And out of those 10 hours, I spent about 8 hours giving back-to-back interviews to different media outlets. My phone would just not go dark for more than a minute, and it'd be like, "Hi, is this Maria? This is BBC Scotland. Is this Maria? This is BBC Oxford. This is BBC Cambridge." I didn't even know there were so many BBCs around. And then on top of that, there's ITV and LBC and Times Radio, and they all wanted to know what's going on. And to be honest, it was kind of helping me because it was distracting me from what was happening around me. And what was happening, of course, in our lane going towards the west and further out is lots of cars, hundreds, thousands of cars. And also the petrol stations were full. And this video was filmed by our journalist friend, Terrell.
This is a long line. Starts here, the queue going for gas. The queue for gas.
This was filmed in Kyiv, but every single petrol station in Kyiv or anywhere in Ukraine looked like this or had even bigger queues. And the ones that didn't have queues outside, it was because they had already run out of petrol. What was also happening is, as I said, our lane was full, but the opposite lane was empty. Nobody wanted to go to Kyiv or further east. Nobody apart from the military vehicles. And that was the first wake-up call that I had that day, is that Jez and I, we were trying to get ourselves safe. We were leaving the country and these people were taking up the arms in order to fight for my country. 10 hours later, my dad drops us off in the outskirts of Lviv and we need to find a taxi to take us to the city centre. I go on the taxi apps and they all show me the same message: no cars available. And having seen the queues for petrol stations, it's easy to understand why the taxi drivers simply didn't have any petrol. Or even if they did, they didn't want to waste it on random passengers just in case they were needed to evacuate their own families or friends. Nevertheless, we managed to locate this one taxi driver who was parked on the curb, and he agreed to take us to Lviv city centre at an inflated price, but we didn't care at that point, we just wanted to keep moving. And then when he dropped us off, he told us that we were his last fare. It was already late evening on February 24th, so I went off the night. That's good, you're going to go and join your family, going to get some rest, some sleep. No, ever. I'm quitting my job as a taxi driver and joining the armed forces of Ukraine because I can't stay aside when such things are happening to my country. He wasn't the only one doing that. Hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian men and women were queuing for their local military registers in order to take up the arms. My dad, having done that 10-hour journey from outside of Kyiv to Lviv without any stops for food or drink, or sleep, he turned around and drove through the night back to outside of Kyiv. And then the next morning, when he woke up, he signed up and joined his territorial defense forces. And that was the second wake-up call that I had, is that, again, Jez and I are leaving. We're turning our backs on my country whilst this brave people are going to fight for it. The bravery of Ukrainian people astonishes me every day.
We arrive in the centre of Lviv. We're tired, we're hungry, we're thirsty. So we pop into Cantonar Bar and get ourselves a quick pint. Now, ordinarily, Cantonar Bar is heaving, really great atmosphere in there. But tonight, it's empty, apart from Andy and his partner Katya. We ask them if there's any food available and say, no, the kitchen's shut. So we go into the centre of Lviv to try and find some food. And it's like a ghost town in there. Domino's is shut. Even McDonald's is shut. Now, if anyone knows anything about Ukrainians, you'll know that they absolutely love their McDonald's. It's like a symbol of anti-Soviet, anti-communist oppression. In fact, in 1997, when the first ever McDonald's opened, there was a queue around the block for days of Ukrainians wanting to get their first ever taste of a Big Mac. Now, for what it's worth, Russia hates this particular McDonald's. It's bombed it now 7 times. The last time was just over a month ago. And it looks like this. But in a symbol of true Ukrainian resilience, 3 days later, it was open again with new improved bomb-proof glass and serving Ukrainians Big Macs. Just so you know, you get a history lesson on McDonald's here. Who'd have thought you got that when you were turning up today? That night, we'd organised to stay with our friend Kyle in the south of Lviv. Kyle's a Northern Irish friend of mine, and he said, not only can you stay with me, but tomorrow morning, I'll be so kind that I'll drive you the 70 kilometres to the border as well. An absolutely wonderful bloke. This is Kyle, by the way. He doesn't look like this anymore. 5 years of being in Ukraine during the war has made him look a lot older. I also look a lot older, but Kyle looks even worse. But I love showing his massive face on here. So if anyone ever wants to take a photo of it and send it to me, he loves finding out that his face has been projected everywhere. Now we get to Kyle's, and he's really upset. You see, we're leaving, we're getting out of there. He's helping us get out of there, but Kyle's staying. And Kyle's staying because his partner, she won't leave. And she won't leave without her brother, and he can't leave because of martial law. So all of them are staying. 11 p.m. comes, and the lights go out in Kyle's apartment. But not just Kyle's apartment, but every apartment, both around us and across the city, as the entire place is plunged into darkness and silence ahead of what's going to happen during the night. Going to sleep when you think you might be bombed is a really strange experience. You take your coat off, you hang it up, you put your hat, your gloves, your scarf in the pockets. You take your boots off and you leave them open so you can slide your feet in quickly, and you put your bag next to it by the front door. And then you go to sleep fully clothed. I got maybe an hour's sleep that night. Kyle the same. Maria, maybe 3. I stayed up. I was checking WhatsApps, emails, interview requests, trying to find out what was going on. 3:45 in the morning, and the sound of a jet plane nearby again. Wake up, wake up, I shout to Maria. But this time, she knows what's going on. She's up like a shot. We run to the front door, slide our feet into the boots, run down 7 flights of stairs, slam the metal door behind us in the basement, and wait for the sound of explosions. 5, 10, 15 minutes, and there's no sound at all. It's very strange. And to make it worse, we're standing in a damp basement, just the 3 of us. No one else has joined us in there, so we don't really know what's going on. Maria goes to the front door. She sticks her phone outside, loads up flight radar, and sees it's a Ukrainian plane. This time, we've been lucky. Kyle says, look, it's 4 a.m. I'm going to drive you to the border. Let's just pack up the car and get going now. We'll beat the morning rush. So we set off on our journey. 20 kilometers away from the border, middle of the night, 5 a.m., and the traffic starts to slow. The single lane traffic suddenly becomes 2 lanes as traffic starts overtaking us on the wrong side of the road. And then it turns into become 3 lanes as traffic's driving down the dirt track, and it just slowly trundles forwards. By 5 a.m., 18 kilometers from the border, and the traffic just stops, and we wait there, unable to move. 2 hours later, and daylight comes, and it shows us exactly what's going on around us. Traffic backed up as far as the eye can see. No one's moving anywhere. Occasionally, I see someone walking around near the car, and I think, that's a great idea. They're stretching their legs that have been in cars for ages. But then I see more people, and more people, and more people, and I work out what's going on. Women are climbing out of the cars and going into the boot and taking out a buggy. They're then going back into the car and taking out their child and putting their child in the buggy. And then going back into the boot again, taking out their suitcase and emptying what they can into a single carrier bag. These women are going to walk 18 kilometres in sub-zero temperatures with their children to reach the border, unable to get any nearer. But that wasn't the upsetting part, because the upsetting part was these women were then going back into the vehicles and saying goodbye to their partners, not knowing when or even if they're ever going to see their partners again. When people talk to me about refugees, I often hear and read in the media about people coming here on boats and all that sort of thing. But the reality is the refugee journey starts right here. These women, they didn't know where they were going. And in fact, most of them ended up sleeping on a sports hall floor for 6 months in Poland, not knowing if they'd ever see their partner again. Many of them haven't.
30 kilometres later, thanks to taking a long cut and the kindness of a police officer at one of the closed-off checkpoints who took Jez's and Kyle's UK passports and said, I shouldn't be doing this, but as a thank you for everything your country has done for Ukraine, I'm going to let you through, we arrive at the border. And the mood at the border is jubilant. People are smiling, they're getting their food bags out, they're catching up. And it's easy to understand why, because you've seen what we've just been through. Those people probably didn't even have the chance to get a lawn car or the kindness of a police officer. A lot of them probably even walked for the whole 18 kilometres. And so we join the queue, and we stand there, and an hour passes, and I realise that we're not really moving at all. I walk to the front of the queue to see where it's leading to, why it's taken so long, and I realise that the queue is not really leading to the Ukrainian side of the border itself, but it's leading to this fenced-off area that only has a single-person gate to go into, and that's why it's taken so long. And when I do that, this police officer spots me, he thinks I'm trying to queue jump, and he shouts at me and tells me to go back to my end of the queue. So I go back and tell Jez what I found.
We wait for another hour. We still haven't moved. So I go for a wander, and I bump into the one police officer. Must be the same one that Maria saw, because there was only one for tens of thousands of people. And I say to him, look, I know this is border control ahead. Is there, a separate queue for Brits or Europeans? And he just laughs at me and points me to the back of the queue. My British exceptionalism has completely failed me once again.
Another hour passes, and again, we're barely moving. And I realise that if we continue standing like this, we're going to be here for days. And I think that I should probably go back to the front of the queue and check if anything's changed, if there's anything that can be done, because otherwise we're never going to get out. This time I'm smarter. I leave my bags with Jess so that it doesn't look like I'm trying to queue jump. And I'm just pretending that I'm going for a wander, that I'm just stretching my legs, because it's difficult to stand in the same place for 3 hours. And I get to the front and I realize that there's now a hole in the fence. Somebody made a hole in there, and the hole is big enough for me and Jess to climb through. And so I go and get Jess, and we somehow manage to make it past the police officer, and we get inside the fenced-off area. The fenced-off area is the size of probably a penalty box. So really, it's safe for a couple of hundreds of people. And there were thousands of us in there. And the first thing I notice actually is a woman fainting and her body being carried out. It's like, to explain it to you, it's like when you're at a concert and you just manage to make it to the front row, and it's great, but there's just so many people around you, you can't really put your arms down. That's how tight, how crowded it was, except that was no concert. There was no entertainment. It was a literal war zone. And even though you're still outside, the amount of people around you just means that you just constantly have to put your head up to get some oxygen. And to make matters worse for myself, I start my period. Because I have endometriosis, that means I'm in excruciating pain. I somehow just about managed to put my hand down in my handbag and locate the ibuprofen. Somebody from the other side of the crowd passes on a bottle of water, and I take the painkillers. What do? I give an interview to the BBC. The BBC asked me to switch my camera on to show what's happening around me, and I say, okay, sure. And then they ask me something that, in hindsight, sounds like one of the strangest things I've ever been asked. They ask me if I can give them a different camera angle. I couldn't even move my arms at all. let alone find new creative angles for the BBC. But then when I look at this screenshot from that interview, I can see why they wanted a different camera angle, because let's face it, that's not the most flattering picture of me. I finish the interview and I start feeling worse again. And to my right, there's this young woman, and she's got a French bulldog of black color by the name of Boomer. And if you think about how dangerous it is for adults like me and Des, it's even more dangerous for little creatures, so children and pets. And so Boomer can't really go on the ground, because the amount of people around him means that somebody would just, and not voluntarily, of course, but step on him and crush him to death. And so the woman has to hold Boomer, and which is very, very difficult for many hours. And because she's got a small suitcase, she can't really put him on that suitcase, because the same thing would happen. He would slip to the ground and die. And so she asks if she can use my suitcase, which is bigger. So, of course, I say yes. And then at one point, she realizes that she's going to move forward, that she's going to go and try and leave this area. And she faces something that must have been the most difficult decision of her life, because she realizes that she can't carry both Boomer and her bag whilst moving forward in this crowd, and she needs to let go of one of them. She lets go of all the possessions that she packed for fleeing the war and takes Boomer into safety. I start feeling worse myself. The lack of oxygen is bad enough, but the endometriosis pain is killing me, and I've realized that if I don't get myself out of here now, I'm just simply not going to make it. At the same time, there's this push for women and children to be given priority and to be let out first. Safe passage for women and children. Safe passage for women and children. This is my chance, I think. I'm going to join this group of women and children. And as I do that, I catch dirty looks, because obviously I'm younger than a lot of those women and I don't have a child with me. And then as soon as they see how pale my face looks, they let me off. And so I follow this line of women and children, and I make it out of the fenced off area through the one single person gate. When I say make it out, I don't just like exit the door as you normally would. The force of the crowd just pushes me out and I just fall down on the ground. And instead of getting up, I just lie there for 15 minutes, just trying to regain my breathing. And when I finally do, I realize that that fenced off area was just the filtering part, and the queue in front of me is the actual queue for the Ukrainian side of the border.
So this is it for me. I'm on my own now. It's just me, my rucksack, and Maria's suitcase containing her own personal wine collection that I've somehow got to get into Poland. The women and children are gone. It's getting dark. I'm surrounded by men who are all far taller than I am. I work out what's going on. There's a single gate, or two single gates. Every so often the gate will swing open, one person will be allowed through, and then the gate will swing shut again. The problem with that is, every time it opens, people step backwards and there's a crush. Every time it's closed again, people push from behind and there's a crush. And because there's no filtration system at all, you're getting crushed from both sides. And I'm really struggling. I keep trying to push people away, but I'm getting crushed and I'm getting terrified. And because I'm standing there, and because it's me, my mind sort of goes back to football. And because I'm thinking of football, I think of the Hillsborough disaster and the 97 people who lost their lives in circumstances very, very similar to that. And I become terrified of what might happen to me. And in fact, because I'm thinking about Hillsborough, I think back to football. Because I'm thinking of football, I think back to United. Because I'm thinking of United, I think of the match a few days earlier against Atletico Madrid. And United was so bad that night. That cannot possibly be the last ever game for United, I see. I deserve better than that. Turns out I probably don't. But it makes me angry and it gives me a focus. It gives me some drive and I lift my arm up. And I just start pushing people around and just trying to keep myself going, lifting my head up, trying to get some air. But honestly, I'm absolutely terrified by this point, and I'm on my own.
3 hours of queuing later, still no sight of Jez. And I try to call him, but every time I call him, his phone is doing this weird thing, is that sometimes I can get through to him, but sometimes it goes straight to voicemail, which leaves me even more worried. And when I do manage to speak to him, he explains to me how it's all men left because they're all taller than him. He can't really see beyond what's right in front of him. He thinks there's only about three rows of men in front of him. But because everything is taken so such a long time. He's not sure when or even if he's going to make it out. And to make matters worse, I start seeing bodies being carried out of that fenced-off area, and the bodies have blood on their face. And in fact, it's confirmed to me that one of them, at least one of them, had been crushed to death, and others had just been crushed with bleeding. And because I don't hear anything from Jazz, I start getting really, really worried. I know I've been queuing for 3 hours and I'm going to lose my spot in the queue, but I must go and try and rescue him. I go up to the fence and there's this pile of bags that people had thrown over the fence, and I climb on top of them and manage to locate Jazz. And then I come up to the security guard who's guarding the gate to let people out. And I explain to him, look, my boyfriend, Jazz, he's British, he's there. I can see him, I can point him to you. Can you please let him out? I know how unsafe it is in there. Please, please, please.
The gate swings open, security guard on a plinth. He lifts his leg up, sticks his foot out and puts his boot on the side of the face in the person in front of me and pushes the head out of the way. At the same time, an arm comes through the crowd and grabs me by the chest, pulls me through a row of four people in front of me and throws me on the ground on the other side. I'm bruised, I'm battered, I'm tired, I'm exhausted, but I'm safe. More importantly, Maria and I are together. Now, you're hearing our story, but there was another story about us at the same time, and that was the press. Hundreds and hundreds of articles were being written about us. We had no idea this was going on in the background, but they were doing that. And incidentally, that story that we just told you about us getting separated and getting back together, well, the BBC were live tweeting our whereabouts. That's how much of a media story we'd become. We had no idea any of this was going on. We queued through the night. By 6:30, temperature had dropped to -4. There was no food, no water, no toilet facilities. Because Maria had started a period, she'd had no alternative but to bleed through her jeans. But we were there, 3 hours away from the front. So to put it in perspective, the exit's there. That took us another 3 hours. By 9:30 the following morning, 23 hours after we arrived at the border, after 1 hour sleep in 47, we finally made it into Poland. My phone decides to spring back into life. Turns out it couldn't work out whether it was in Poland or Ukraine or Ukraine or Poland. So I'd just given up on doing, well, anything at all. And a flurry of messages come through. And amongst them, there's a video message for me.
Maria and Jez, good luck. Hurry up. Hurry up back. We need the good guys. We need the good guys. Hang in there.
Now, quick quiz question. Does anyone, and please, I really hope there's at least one person, stick the hand up if they know who that is. Yes, thank you. Because we normally do this and nobody does, and I get really annoyed. Who are we looking at there? Johnny Marr, Smith's guitarist, a Mancunian legend. A hero of mine had sent us a good luck message. And I burst into tears. You see, the worst of the physical journey that we thought was over, but the mental health journey, that was just beginning. And that was a journey that saw me bursting into tears sporadically every single day for the next 2.5 years.
And that also happens to me as soon as we cross into Poland. And what we see is this just a flurry of volunteers. Lots and lots of volunteers have all congregated at the Polish side of the border. And they're giving out things like free water, free biscuits. And without me having to ask for anything, this random hand just appears in front of me carrying a bag of sandwiches. And I see that the sandwiches have meat inside of them. So I explain that Jez is Jewish, he can't have pork. And without me saying anything else, another hand just appears again, just seconds later. And this time carrying just sandwiches with cheese in there. And then a cup of coffee is given to me. And it's just the simple, cheap, soluble coffee that you can find in your corner store. But it tasted absolutely divine after 23 hours of standing and queuing without food, water, or toilet facilities, but even longer without a hot drink. There's also people offering rides, free rides to anywhere within Poland, to cities like Lublin, Krakow, Warsaw, and even to Gdansk, which is a good few hours up in the north, absolutely for free. It was incredible. Jez and I consult for a couple of minutes and we decide that we're going to go to Krakow first to get some rest and respite.
When we're in Krakow, attending to our duties, recovering, we have to face the elephant in the room. Whilst Maria had applied for her visitor visa to the UK over a month ago, and we'd had a meeting with the British Embassy and they said, yep, we'll expedite it, and they were telling other people to apply as well, the visa hadn't turned up. So we had little alternative but to travel from Krakow to Warsaw to pay the British Embassy a visit to find out precisely where her visa was.
Among the many incredible acts of kindness that Poland was doing for Ukraine and that at that time in 2022 was free rail travel for all Ukrainians anywhere within Poland. And the way this worked is you had to turn up to the train station, to the ticket desk, explain where you wanted to go, show your Ukrainian passport, and they would print out a ticket for you. And the ticket looked exactly like a regular ticket, except where it says cost, it said 0 zloty, meaning that it's free. And I was so amazed by that and feeling so grateful that I took a selfie and I put it on my Twitter page. To this day, that picture has amassed 10 million views. There were entire articles written about this photo in Poland. It was amazing how viral it went.
I took a photo of that ticket and posted it up on my Twitter. Thirteen likes. Such a popularity contest. I wish I was a beautiful Ukrainian, I'll tell you now. We arrive at the British Embassy and there's a queue of people just walking away looking despondent. It turns out the embassy and the visa centre are two completely different buildings. And the visa centre's just a small room in a hotel and it's only open 2 half-days a week. So they can't do anything. But we're queuing and it's our turn to go and speak to the embassy. Whilst we're queuing though, we start talking to people and we're saying, well, why do you want to come to the UK? And some of them say, I've got a distant family member there. Some say, I've got some friends. Others say, I know a few words of English and it's more than I know of any other language. It turns out that when your life is reduced to a single bag, you'll go anywhere that will give you the slightest advantage over another place. Curiously though, one person turns around to me and he says, Boris Johnson is a good man. Gets worse. Boris Johnson is a good man and he will look after me. Next month, we're talking at the Conservative Party conference doing this. I'm so excited to see how that line goes down. It's going to be amazing. I cannot wait. Eventually, though, it's our turn at the embassy. British passport in hand, I go and I press the buzzer. Hi, I'd like to come in and have a chat, please. And they turn around and go, can you come back in 45 minutes? And I'm like, no, just fled a war. You're my embassy. I'd like to come in and see you, please. And say, well, unfortunately, we're on lockdown at the moment. Boris Johnson, second mention tonight, and Liz Truss are about to turn up and do a press conference, so the embassy's on lockdown. I thought, well, this is handy, isn't it? So I get on my phone. Hi, is that Five Live? It's Jez speaking. I'm standing outside the British Embassy. Boris and Liz are about to turn up. Maybe we can organise for me to go and have a chat with them and find out where the hell Maria's visa is. Hi, is that Sky News? Hi, is that LBC? After the third call, there was a knock at the window, and like a naughty schoolchild, I was summoned inside. The British Embassy, by the way, to be fair to them, were absolutely fantastic. They said, look, we're on lockdown. We can't help you right now, but give us all the details. We'll look into it. Wait outside. We'll give you a call. And so we wait outside. Boris and Liz turn up, drive past us, drive in, do the press conference, get heckled by one of Maria's friends about not closing the skies over Ukraine, and drive off again. They don't wave, they don't even say hello. Bastards. Shortly after that time, though, we get a phone call from them. And the embassy explains it like this. They go, Maria's applied for her visa. Her visa's been accepted. And the visa itself is in the post, except we don't know where it's been posted to. It could be Lviv, could be Kyiv, could be anywhere. We don't know where it is. And until it's actually in her passport, it's not live and we can't reprint it. So her only option is to go down the visitor visa pathway and reapply for a new visa. The only problem with that, the visitor visa pathway is closed because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So Maria is stranded. To put that clearly again for you, Maria had done absolutely every single thing correct, but because the Home Office had lost Maria's visa, she was now stranded in Poland. So I get back on the phone. Hi, is that the Daily Mail? Oh, have I got a story for you. Is that the Daily Mirror? Is that the Telegraph? Is that the Times? All in all, a dozen media outlets were looking and prepared to run this story and were phoning up the Home Office for comment for what they were going to say about them. Later that afternoon, I get a phone call from the embassy. Hi, Jez. Good news. The Home Office have decided to offer Maria a visa waiver. I know it's more game show than you think. A visa waiver, you say? What's that? And you go, well, it sounds like this. Essentially, you turn up at the airport, they check your passport and they say, where's your visa? And you go, I've got a visa waiver. And they go, oh, why didn't you say so? Come on through. Here's the red carpet. Now, if that sounds a bit ridiculous to you, it certainly did to me. So I said to them, can you send me an email telling me about this? No, we can't do that. Can you send me a text message? Can you write me a letter? I'll pop back and I'll pick it up now. So honestly, it's no problem at all. No, we can't do that. Just tell us what day, what time and which flight you're going to be on and we'll ensure that it's on the computer system. So, putting my complete faith... Tell you, we're going so over time here, it's brilliant. Put my complete faith in the civil service. I book a flight from Krakow to Manchester. This is it. We might finally be going home.
Upon arrival at Krakow Airport, because I'm Ukrainian, I have to report to the check-in desk for a visa check. The Ryanair employee takes my passport, she flicks through it, and she says, where's your visa for the UK? Oh, well, I have a visa waiver, I explain. A visa what? A visa waiver. What's that? Oh, well, it's a permission for me to board this specific plane and to go to Manchester. Okay, can you show it to me? Oh, no. It's not a physical thing. It's just something that's going to be in your computer. So if you just log on, you'll find my name on there. Do you have a reference number or anything confirming this? No, just go on your computer, check the visa waiver system, and you'll find my name on there. She goes on her computer, puts something in, and she says, just checked. Nobody with a visa waiver on this flight. Jess starts getting more and more visibly annoyed, and I can just see him just dialing his embassy contact to find out what's going on, until this other Ryanair employee overhears the conversation. She says, a visa waiver? I saw somebody with a visa waiver on this flight. Let's check this other system. They go on a different computer, put my name in, and manage to locate me on that list. And I'm allowed, Jez and I are allowed to board the flight to Manchester. A couple of hours later, we land in Manchester and we go to the UK border agency desk and a similar conversation starts. Do you have a visa for the UK? I have a visa waiver. Thankfully, this time, they actually knew what a visa waiver is. What Jez and I didn't know, though, is that the visa waiver itself doesn't guarantee you entry into the country, because what happens when somebody in the UK reports to an airport with a visa waiver is that the airport staff need to get in touch with the Home Office and explain to the Home Office that such and such passenger at this location, on this date, and at this time is trying to make entry with a visa waiver, and the Home Office needs to greenlight that passenger's entry. And even though we're in the 21st century and there are multiple modes of contact, that entire conversation, interaction has to happen via email. So the airport staff emails the Home Office, and until the Home Office emails back to say that it's okay for me to go through, we have to stay in the airport. And so they sit us down in this little island in the middle of all the queue and for UK border agency, and they officially detain me. Yeah, that's right. They give me this detention note. And whilst Jez and I sit and wait to see what's going to happen with this Home Office email, two suited middle-aged men come up to us. And they start chatting to us. And I read their badges, and they say counterterrorism police. Well, this is great, I think. After fleeing my own home country, leaving my family behind, not knowing what's going to happen to my country or to anybody I love or know, I now must prove to the UK that I'm not a terrorist. And the two men start asking us questions, and they listen to what we're saying. And to be honest, they don't really care for Jez's answers. They're just watching me and how I react. And they ask us about the journey and our story and about Ukraine. And we don't hold back. We tell them everything. We tell them what we told you. And as they listen, we can just see the color draining from their faces. They probably weren't expecting to hear such a story. And then they say, okay, well, thanks so much for answering all our questions. But we just got a few more, if that's okay. Honestly, Jez says, we're happy to answer all of your questions, but if you're that interested in every single detail of our story, why don't you put our names into Google? You'll find hundreds of articles about it. Or alternatively, just step outside the airport. There are three media crews waiting to talk to us. I'm sure they'll be able to fill in all the gaps in our story. Oh, that's fine. We've had enough. And they leave us alone. And sometime after that, the response from the Home Office comes through and officially allows me entry into the country. But before the airport staff actually allows me to cross into the UK, they ask me if I know when I'm going to be back to Ukraine. I just fled. There's a war going on. Like, do you know when Putin and his army are going to leave my country alone? Probably that's when. What a weird thing to ask. And so we arrive in Greater Manchester to Jez's house. And a similar wave of kindness to what we saw in Poland happens here in the UK, in Greater Manchester. Neighbors pop round and they bring me flowers. One of them comes round with his four-year-old son, who made a drawing for me saying welcome home with Ukrainian flags. And the local businesses offer us free things because I'm probably one of the first displaced Ukrainians to arrive after the full-scale invasion, but probably the first displaced Ukrainian they had come across. So they want to make me feel as welcome as possible. And so they offer things like free cake, free tea, free coffee for us. A local hairdressing salon gave me a free haircut. They said they couldn't really do anything for Jez, though.
Every time we do this, she makes a joke about me being bald and everybody laughs and everybody finds it hilarious. My jokes are well crafted. I work really hard on them. And all she does is turn them and go, oh, look, Jez is bald. Honestly, it's worse than the ridiculous thing with the ticket.
It's not a joke. It's all true. The following Saturday, there's a rally in support of Ukraine happening in central Manchester at Piccadilly Gardens, and I'm due to speak at that rally. And to get to Piccadilly Gardens from our house, we have to go through Manchester Piccadilly train station. And outside of the Manchester Piccadilly train station, there's this ramp that takes you to Piccadilly Gardens. And the ramp is full of cafes and bars, and because it's already early March and there's a tiny glimpse of sunshine, and you'll know perfectly well that the tiniest sight of sunshine, all British people just populate the beer gardens and have pints. So the bars and the pubs, they buzzing with people. And the people are having pints and they're laughing and they're celebrating handoos, and there's billboards announcing new albums. I just couldn't handle it. Because a few hours earlier, Jez and I were fleeing. And before that, we were in a literal war zone where every single conversation was about the war. And here people laugh, they celebrate, they drink. Do they not know what's happening in my country? Do they not care? And then I realized that the easiest way to explain this to somebody who's not been through a war is by comparing it to grief. When somebody close to you dies and you spend hours or sometimes days just in the immediate circle of your family and your loved ones, and then you have to step outside to get on with your life, and you see that the world just moves on, nothing stopped because of the grief in your family. And in a way, I was grieving the loss of my home country as I knew it. And that sense of grief, as well as survivor's guilt, is what drives Jez and me with our work. We set up All for Ukraine, and we do activities for displaced Ukrainians. To this day, I've done free walking tours of Manchester for 3,000 displaced Ukrainians in Greater Manchester. It's nearly half of all displaced Ukrainians in there. And I did the same in Liverpool and Newcastle. And we also do museum trips, workshops for Ukrainian families. And we also do talks like this. And the talks are a way to support all of our work, with displaced Ukrainian community. And in the flyers that I hope all of you received, but if not, there's more at the front, at the end, we provide some QR links to our organization, All for Ukraine, that you can support and therefore support our work with All for Ukraine, with displaced Ukrainians, but also our partner charities. And as part of educating non-Ukrainian people about Ukraine, we take them to Lviv, to the west of Ukraine, and we also take them to Unbroken, which is a rehabilitation center that treats Ukrainian soldiers and civilians and gives them free prosthetics and everything free of charge. And it's a way for British people to learn more about Ukraine and support Ukraine more.
Our story is one of luck, guilt, grief, survivor's guilt, duty, obligation. We're really lucky to have all of you here to watch us. But it's thanks to the generosity of Paul and Joanna and stuff from Greenbelt, who've agreed to put us on. Jonathan putting us up with us. He's our artist liaison. He's been brilliant. You know, but people come and listen to our story. But really, actually, this isn't about us or our story. You see, Taras Chuchman was a Carpati Lviv Ultra, a really close friend of Kyle's. In the early days, he gave up his job as software engineer to go and fight for Ukraine. 2 months later, he was killed by Russian shelling in Donetsk. In his honour, Kyle set up Taras Chuchman's Invincible Defenders, a charity which takes injured soldiers from the 5 rehabilitation centres around Lviv for a typical ordinary day out at the football. There's a really interesting thing that goes on. When you're on the front lines and you're fighting, everybody knows you're there. You're highly visible, even though you're not physically visible. You're highly visible. People send you food, they'll send you clothes, they'll send you weapons. Equally, when you're back in the community, people send you, you know, they'll see you and they'll help you and they'll support you. But when you're in the rehabilitation centre, learning how to walk again, waiting for prosthetic limbs, learning how to start your life again, it's very lonely. And you often feel forgotten about. So what Kyle does is he takes them to the football. And the fans come up to them. And they shake their hand. They ask for photos with them. They thank them for their service. At the end of the game, the players often go up into the stands and do exactly the same thing. And it gives them some sort of hope, some sort of support, some help with their mental health. And speaking of mental health, Paul from the Curry Knights at the very beginning, in 2015, and then later on in 2019, set up Lifeline Ukraine, Ukraine's only suicide prevention hotline. Now, mental health isn't really something that's actually done very much in Eastern Europe. It's getting a little better, but it's not massively done. Back in 2021, the suicide prevention hotline was receiving about 1,000 calls a month. By mid-2025, that number had risen to 6,500, and then their funding was cut. That's right, in the middle of Russia's all-out invasion, Ukraine doesn't have a fully functioning suicide prevention hotline. It now relies on text messages to save people's lives at their lowest point. Andy from Canton Arbar, good friend of mine, November 2024, conscripted. He's now serving north of Kharkiv. Tony from the football, ineligible to be conscripted, but has given up his job to help build drones, work in drone and drone technologies. I can't really say much more about what he does. It's highly, highly confidential.
But not everybody's been this lucky. You may remember this picture of me standing in Vinnytsia in the center west of Ukraine. Well, just a couple of months later, that exact spot looked like this. An absolutely ruthless Russian attack in broad daylight in the city center of Vinnytsia, where there are no military targets, just shops and businesses and residential buildings, killed 23 people, including a 4-year-old girl with Down syndrome. That can be no justification for attacks like this.
Mel and Tony broke up a few years later. They both moved on and got new partners. Mel met Andre. Andre, since he was a small boy, wanted to be a fighter pilot and fulfilled his dream of joining the Ukrainian Air Force. They sent him over to the US to train, where, because he was so focused on being the best pilot he could, he refused to touch alcohol, earning him the nickname and the call sign Juice. In 2023, in a training accident, Juice was killed. Not only was an incredibly talented fighter pilot, but he was also the person behind the incredibly popular Ghost of Kiev meme.
And this is Max Levin, my colleague from my Hromadske days, a very talented photo and video journalist. He could just make any story come alive. Max and I worked on a story about surrogacy in Ukraine during quarantine, but February 2022 changed things for Max, just like it did for most Ukrainian journalists. And Max decided that he would just concentrate on war journalism. And the first month since the full-scale invasion, our native region, my native region, and Max's native region, the Kyiv region, was occupied. And Max was using a drone to take imagery of the occupied areas. And he lost his drone, but because he wanted those high-quality pictures from the drone, he went to the forest with his friend in the occupied area to try and find it. But instead, the Russians found them. And they captured the two men, and they gagged Max, and they tortured him, and they executed him at short range, setting his car on fire, probably the same car that we would have taken for our work trip. In April last year, I visited Max's grave and laid some flowers there. As I was leaving the grave, I bumped into Max's brother, who actually is now serving in the armed forces himself, and the brother's family. And I had a conversation with them, and we shared some memories of Max. And it's hard enough for me as a former colleague, as a friend, to come to terms with the loss of Max, but I can't even begin to imagine what it's like for them.
One of the great things that I've found over the years about being a United fan is the fact that we have fan groups from all over the world. Ukraine is no different in this respect. Sasha Kukin was founder of Kyiv Reds, the largest United fan group in all of Ukraine. His love for United was unparalleled, and whilst he wouldn't have been able to attend the Bestia, the George Best pub, every week to watch United, because of family commitments, his love for United never died. In early 2022, when Russia controlled Bucha, he was trying to escape and drive his wife and daughter to safety. Russian troops opened fire against the vehicle, killing Sasha and injuring his wife and daughter. While Sasha may be gone, I'm pleased to say that his wife and daughter have made a full recovery and are now living in Germany.
And this is Victoria Roshina, another colleague of mine from my Hromadske days. Vika and I worked in the same office for a couple of years, and back in that time, she was working on this, for me, seemed like the most boring stories. So she would go to court hearings and sit through many, many hours long court hearings, and after them, she would chase the person that she needed for her story and try and get the answers that she needed for the story. Incredible stamina. But then again, the full-scale invasion changed things for Vika. And she decided that it was her calling, her responsibility to report on what was happening in the occupied areas of Ukraine. In 2023, Russia bombed the Kakhovka Dam, which led to floods all over the south of Ukraine. And so she headed to the southeast of the country to report on what was happening in the south, but also on what was happening in her native region near Zaporizhia, where the Enerhodar nuclear power plant is, which is to this day occupied by Russia. The Russians used a reconnaissance drone to hunt Vika down, and they captured her, and she spent a year in Russian prisons. And during that year, we didn't really have any updates about Vika, about where exactly she was, her state, her health, or the conditions she's held in, until October 2024. Vika's dad got a message from the Russian government that Vika had died. Yes, died. That's the phrase they used. A healthy 27-year-old woman doesn't just die. The things they must have done to her. And after the reports of her death, they refused to send her body back for weeks afterwards. And when it finally arrived, it was missing her brain, her larynx, and her eyes, likely to hide signs of torture and strangulation. In April this year, I also visited Vika's grave and put some flowers there. And just to remind you that Vika and Max were just journalists. They were wearing civilian clothes. They were just trying to do their job, and that's what Russia did to them. And they weren't the only ones. There are dozens of Ukrainian journalists who are still held captive by Russia or have been killed. Christmas Day 2022. Jez and I are in Greater Manchester visiting Jez's friends, and we're just about to sit down for our Christmas lunch, and I'm just about to tuck in, and a text message from my brother arrives, informing me that my 91-year-old grandmother, who carried the same name as me, Maria Romanenko, had passed away. When people ask me if I made the right decision fleeing Ukraine and coming to the UK, I don't know how to answer that question. Because on the one hand, I avoided the fate of Vika and Max and other Ukrainian journalists and made sure that I would be safe and be able to do my work. But on the other hand, I never got to say goodbye to my grandma. I didn't get to spend her last months of her life with her, and I couldn't even attend her funeral because of how quickly funerals take place in Ukraine. And whilst our pathway from Ukraine to the UK to safety, the support that we had from Jez's friends, from my family, from Jez's family in Greater Manchester, from the media, the house that we were that was waiting for us in Greater Manchester, the money that we had to support ourselves on our journey, that's all unique to us. The struggles, though, that I face as a displaced Ukrainian are not. 48% of Ukrainians know somebody killed by Russia. War is not about numbers or equipment. War is about the people, their stories, their lives. Thank you for listening. Slava Ukraini.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.